at the First National Women's Liberation Conference. By 1971, the concept was so popular that a pamphlet distributed by the Chicago Women's Liberation Union began by stating definitively, "Consciousness-raising groups are the backbone of the women's liberation movement." 48 years after Forer expressed the need to raise our consciousness, I was invited to do the same, in the very same city. The friend of mine who planned this meeting, Erin Dark, had just come off starring in Good Girls Revolt, an Amazon show that centered on women, specifically the women of a fictionalized version of Newsweek, getting woke to the need for women's liberation in 1969 into 1970. The show was based on a true story. In 1970, 46 female researchers at Newsweek sued the magazine for gender discrimination because, as women, they were allowed to research and report stories, but not actually write them. Both in real life and on the show, consciousness-raising meetings played a key role in getting enough women on board with filing an official complaint and in organizing plans for such a complaint. Preparing for and shooting the scenes that depicted this awakening had made a real impression on Erin. The consciousness-raising meeting scenes were some of my favorite scenes to shoot, and I just remember every time we would shoot one, I'd just sit there being like, "Why don't we do this anymore?" Erin told me. It was a huge part of what empowered so many women to know that they weren't alone. So I left the show thinking about that, and then the election happened. Erin felt like Donald Trump's election was an attack on her humanity as a woman. So the next day, she composed an email to the women in her life, inviting them to a consciousness-raising meeting, like the one she had acted out on Good Girls Revolt. 3 days later, she headed down to D.C. for a Good Girls Revolt-related panel with Eleanor Holmes Norton, current congresswoman, and the former ACLU lawyer who had helped organize the Women of Newsweek. Eleanor spoke about what feminism looked like in the 60s and 70s, and what she worried younger women might miss out on. She worried about our generation of women because we seemed to be so separated. It was like we had been trained to compete against each other for the success that we now knew was possible, remembered Erin. As soon as she said that, I realized that was the thing I had been feeling and couldn't really put words to. I just deeply missed a sense of community among women. Erin hoped that gathering some women in her living room might be a first step toward reclaiming that sense of community. So, a week after getting Erin's message, I headed over to her apartment, not quite sure what I'd be walking into. That first night, I found myself in a room with about 20 other women and one woke dude. Very quickly, it became clear that although this space was not going to be totally exclusionary to men, its mission was going to be built around and led by women. That evening included a lot of feelings and a lot of tears and a lot of open-ended questions. 3 hours later, we knew that it would become something more. Over the months that followed, we continued to meet. And when a few people emailed Erin asking if they could bring boyfriends or straight male friends into the fold, she decided against it. "The experience of being a woman is something that everyone in that room understands," Erin explained. "I do think that sense of common understanding is so powerful, and it has led to people being able to come and feel really comfortable and included immediately, and also to feel okay being vulnerable." Another group member and friend, Kate Deering, told me that having a women-focused space helped create an atmosphere that was both emotionally intimate and primed for practical action. "We have a bunch of highly functional, effective women that will just throw down. But at the same time, there is a kind of intimacy," she said. "People come and share stories, and we do hug and cheerlead and emotionally support each other. And then we're also like, okay, how do we want to be engaged? How do we make a difference in this reality?" And I think that combination is so powerful, so good for souls. By mid-December, the group had a name, Women to the Front. And by mid-July, the group had raised more than $15,000 for EMW Women's Surgical Center, the very last abortion clinic in the state of Kentucky. The event was a resounding success. We raffled off Sam B tickets and did sound checks and danced the night away. My friends, new and old, had created a space where people could gather and love one another and affirm their commitment to building a world where women's bodies are their own, where activism and joy can go hand in hand. To tweak a beloved Hamilton quote, "Women, we get the job done." Second-wave feminists understood the value of creating spaces for and by women. Half a century later, those spaces are no less valuable. They may look a little different in 2018 than in 1968, but the basic tenet of fostering shared experiences and understanding remains. The internet, specifically social media, has offered endless opportunities for virtual connection. I am a part of three different feminist listservs, on which women are able to have near daily debates, share information, and organize real-life meetups in various cities. We need spaces both on and offline where we can build and share ideas without interruption, said Jamia Wilson, former executive director of WAM, Women, Action, and the Media, the organization that runs one of those aforementioned feminist listservs. And without mansplaining, and to be able to develop strength as a community and to create shared strategy passing. Advocacy organizations such as WAM have learned that the best way to activate existing members and reach new ones is, surprise, online. Higher Heights, an organization dedicated to building a national infrastructure to harness Black women's political power and leadership potential, often hosts Twitter-based Sunday brunches, using the hashtags #BlackWomenLead and #SundayBrunch. These hashtags help facilitate discussions on topics such as running for office and what's at stake for Black women under the Trump administration. Many women I spoke to, both established activists and organizers and newly minted ones, expressed that in the wake of Trump's election, they simply wanted to be around other women. So it only seemed natural to begin new organizing efforts with other women in mind. Anna Poe Kest, who lives in New York City and works in city government, spent much of November and December 2016 going to various political-ish meetups with women friends and colleagues. One such gathering was made up entirely of women who work in city government, a lot of type A personalities, as Anna put it. These meetups felt cathartic at first, but after a while she began to feel as though there was a lot of talking going on, but not a whole lot of productive, concrete action. Then the Women's March happened. Anna and a few of those same women, who also happened to be her close friends, knew they wanted to go down to D.C. They decided to tap back into the group they had met up with weeks prior and head down to D.C. "All of us still had it in our minds," said Anna. "We weren't ready to let it die." They ended up renting a big van and piling about 15 people into it. They also found housing in D.C. for every person who caravaned down with them. It was completely chaotic, and it felt great. Reinvigorated from the march, Anna and her friends Alana Leopold, Monica Klein, and Ishani Parikh reconvened in New York to really think through what they could do to resist on a longer-term basis. Their first brainstorm session lasted 6 hours. They wanted to make sure that if they created something, it would fill an existing gap, rather than trying to replicate work that other people were already doing. So they spent time thinking about their unique skills and what they had access to that other young women who are otherwise like them might not. Part of it is that having grown up in this world, having had our first jobs in politics and New York City government, we've been able to make all these connections to these amazing women who are all of our mentors, the best, most sought-after communications specialists for campaigns, or the second-in-command below the mayor, for example, said Anna. At the same time, we saw a lot of our friends, who maybe had never been in a courthouse before, or had never been to a mass protest before the Women's March, and they were so inspired by it but didn't really know how to do anything afterward. They were going to get fatigued and needed to figure out how to turn that into sustained activism that doesn't just die out. Protest is not the new brunch. It was for like a month, and it's not anymore. And so out of those brainstorm sessions came the Broad Room. Its mission is ambitious: to train an army of young women in NYC to take political action and resist the right-wing agenda. To build this nonviolent army, the Broad Room does three things. One, holds practical trainings on activism and government, led by experts, that is, the mentors of the organization's founders. Two, sends out a weekly newsletter, the Broad Memo, with practical calls to action. And 3, holds social events to foster connection between members, because what's activism without some levity and joy? And, if you haven't already gathered, each of these 3 things is led by and for women. Anna told me that early on, the women of the Broad Room decided that they would be happy to have men donate their time and skill sets to behind-the-scenes work or to fundraising, but any role at the center, whether as leadership or trainer or benefactor, would be taken up by women. If a man wants to do some pro bono design work for us, that we'll obviously give credit for, we will let him do that. And men can give us money and do all that shit. But anyone who's actually benefiting from our work is going to be a woman, said Anna. So all the trainers are women. Any speaker at any of our events is a woman. We feature art in each of our Broad Memos, and all of that is by women. Part of that decision, I think, came on a personal level. All of us working in politics, we're in very male-dominated spaces. And there's a totally different way that you act in a woman-dominated space, as opposed to a space where there are men. 'Cause men often take over the room. The advantages of having an activist space run by women go beyond women feeling empowered to speak up and lead. There are simply things, like motherhood, that are understood and considered more frequently and with greater care in such spaces. Women's March National Co-Chair Bob Bland gave birth to her 2nd daughter, Chloe, about 10 days into March planning. After spending 3 days in the hospital, Bland was back out and organizing, with her newborn in tow. Coming from the fashion and startup worlds, she found working with her March co-chairs a welcome contrast, like night and day. And Bland says that it never would have been possible for her to work as hard as she did leading up to the march if she hadn't been working with other women. I went straight back into organizing, she said, and the only way I could do that was because the Women's March was women-led and because Tamika Mallory is a mother of her son, Tariq, and then Linda Sarsour has 3 children of her own, teenagers, and Carmen Perez has just so many nieces and nephews that she's helped to raise. As much as we were working ourselves to the core every single day, harder than we'd ever worked in our lives, just knowing that it was okay for me to bring my child and that I didn't have to explain things was incredible. It was all right for me to breastfeed in public, and I wasn't going to be asked to go sit over there. Understanding that a new mom has to breastfeed seems simple, but it's something that even many modern workplaces still struggle with. Given both the recognition that women-led spaces are best equipped to address these simple needs, and the reality that freelancers now make up more than 1/3 of the American workforce, it's no wonder that workspaces that explicitly cater to women are having such a moment. Women's co-working spaces and social clubs such as The Wing, New York City, Hera Hub, San Diego and D.C., Rise Collaborative Workspace, St. Louis, The Hivery, Mill Valley, California, Paper Dolls, Los Angeles, and The Riveter, Seattle, have popped up all over the country. Though these types of spaces are primarily for working on your side hustle, or main hustle, networking, and holding professional meetings, many of them have unflinchingly embraced political engagement and expression as part of their mission. The Wing allowed Women's March organizers to use its space at no cost during the weeks leading up to the march and bussed 100 of its members down to D.C. on January 21st. The Hivery ended up renting 6 buses to take its members to the San Francisco march. These spaces, by virtue of being by and for women, end up being political, almost by default. As The Wing co-founder Audrey Gelman put it, being a girl is no longer politically neutral. Your identity, whether you like it or not, is now political. 6 steps to forming your own lady-centered space. 1. Think about what you need. Do you want to create a space for general brainstorming and work? A group that meets monthly to organize around one particular issue. A place where women can share practical strategies for surviving sexism at school or the workplace. Go into this process with at least a loose vision of what you want to get out of it. 2. Recruit other like-minded lady friends. You can't have a lady gang of one. Reach out to your friends at first, then widen the pool. Invite women to invite other women into the fold. When you create a space with a common aim in mind, you may make some really fantastic, talented, and inspiring new friends in the process. At the end of every meeting, make sure to encourage members to bring new people next time. 3. Find a physical space you can use. Consistency is a good way to make sure that people keep coming back. Find a classroom, apartment, family room, or public space, a library or a park with picnic tables where you can meet. If you live in a city that already has a women's co-working space or community center, email the people who run those spaces and see if they'd be willing to help you out. 4. Work with the others in your group to define some concrete goals. Don't meet just for the sake of meeting. After your introductory event, sit down with the people you've invited into this space and really talk about what your goals are. Create a mission statement, write it down, and continue to return to it. Having the occasional informal group therapy session is great, but make sure that you're ultimately making plans to get off your chairs and couches and out into the world. 5. Identify other groups that you can collaborate with and support. Once you've established your group, look beyond yourselves. Research the groups that are already doing the work you want to contribute to in your area. Call them up and ask them what they need. Is it money? Volunteers? Bodies at protests? Whatever they say, use the resources you have to help them out. 6. Don't forget to have fun. Celebrate milestones, big and small. Dance around. Show affection. Recognize that joy can be radical. Chapter 9. Fake news, schmake news. How to sort through all the BS. The first time Melissa Zimdars really noticed the proliferation of fake news was the day that she got fooled by it. During the summer of 2016, the assistant professor of communication and media at Merrimack College was scrolling through her Facebook feed when she came across an article that said Green Bay Packers quarterback Aaron Rodgers had endorsed Democratic presidential candidate Bernie Sanders. Being both a Packers fan and a Bernie fan, she thought, hell yeah, and quickly shared the article. Shortly afterwards, she realized that the story wasn't true. She had been duped by a viral hit based on lies, or as Kellyanne Conway would put it, alternative facts. After Zimdars fell prey to this packer of lies, she started noticing these stories more and more. Some of the fake news stories that went viral during 2016 were totally inconsequential, such as a piece that claimed Star Wars was being shot in northern Wisconsin. But others were less benign, such as the story that claimed Hillary Clinton was running a child sex ring out of a pizza restaurant, or the one that claimed Florida Democrats wanted to impose Sharia law on women. One day, during her mass communication class, a lecture course filled with freshmen and sophomores, Zimdars was leading a discussion about media bias. A few of her students commented that liberal news bias wasn't straightforward. They believed that there was a more coordinated conspiracy behind it. To illustrate this point, a student showed her a photo of a Newsweek cover that he had found online. The cover featured Hillary Clinton, along with the headline, "Madam President." In reality, it was one of two covers that Newsweek had prepped before November 8th, so that they would be prepared to go to press regardless of how the election played out. Pretty standard practice for a magazine. But certain fringe right-wing personalities and news outlets had seized upon the image, declaring it evidence that Newsweek had colluded with the Clinton campaign to rig the election. Once Zimdars explained the context of the image, it made complete sense to her students. But the incident made her realize even more deeply the damage that misleading news can do in the internet age. It just demonstrated to me how quickly and convincingly this kind of information can circulate and have huge effects, Zimdars told me. So in an effort to help her students more responsibly sort through all the newsy noise they see on social media every day, Zimdars decided to be proactive. She put together a comprehensive Google Doc that included tips for analyzing news sources, as well as a list of false, misleading, clickbaity, and/or satirical news sources, tagged with the type of bias each website might present. The list includes news sources that present totally false news, news sources that present credible news through a political lens, satirical news sources that promote conspiracy theories, news sources that present junk science, news sources that rely on clickbait headlines, that is, headlines that might exaggerate a point or tease the reader with an answer to get that reader to click into an article, and government-run news sources. Zimdar's list is nuanced and thoughtful, providing real instruction to those who take the time to actually read it thoroughly. Unsurprisingly, many people didn't. The list went viral, and because of its virality, it became mischaracterized. The nuance was largely lost, as the list was labeled as a fake news list, rather than a list of news sources that contains varying types of bias and satire, carefully and specifically labeled. Eventually, Zimdars wrote an op-ed in the Washington Post about the series of events. I've noticed, with some concern, that the same techniques that get people to click on fake or overhyped stories are also being used to get people to read about my own list, she wrote, explaining the original intent of the list. I wanted to help my students navigate a cluttered, complicated, and often overwhelming media environment by alerting them to be skeptical and rigorous at all times. Skeptical and rigorous. Two things that any consumer of media should be. These traits take work. It's easier to just retweet or repost without reading an article than to take the time to read it carefully and to make sure that the conclusions it's drawing aren't spurious or suspect. But being a thoughtful consumer of media is rewarding. Not only does it make you more informed, always a plus, but it also may help restore your faith in the relationship between the media, so often thought of as a distant, coordinated monolith, in direct conflict with the user, and those who need that media most in times of democratic turmoil. As Zimdars told me, what I try to remind my students is that skepticism is healthy. We should all be skeptical of information all the time, right? But it can't become cynicism. 5 tips for every responsible newsreader. That means you. 1. Be your own filter. Read your news carefully. If something raises your internal antennas or feels a little fishy, trust that instinct and look into it more. We're going to have to really understand instinctively and make our own value judgments of what is right and what smells wrong, media critic and activist Jamia Wilson advises. We need to see alternative facts for what they are. And if a story doesn't seem totally above board, resist hitting like. 2. Fact check, fact check, fact check. Before spreading information on a given topic, make sure you actually have a grasp on that information. And if something feels off, look at reliable sites such as Snopes or PolitiFact to double-check the truthiness of the info. 3. Find news sources that you trust. Do your research and decide on a few news outlets that feel steady and reliable to you. Follow them on social media and read them regularly. 4. But make sure to read widely. This doesn't just mean oscillating between reading news from outlets that are traditionally categorized as left-wing and those categorized as right-wing, though that could be part of it if that's the variety you're looking for. The most important thing is to simply vary your media diet. No one should get all of her information from one source. After all, the Boston Globe may have the best reporting on one particular topic, while the Wall Street Journal or The Hill or The New York Times delves beautifully into another. No one media organization will teach you everything you need to know about the world. 5. Support local news. News organizations should, at their core, be about holding those with the most power responsible for their actions. The best way for media outlets to be able to do this is to A. have the funding to dedicate enough reporters to a variety of topic areas, and B. have enough outlets based in a variety of locations across the country or region they cover. There's nothing wrong with having national outlets that are headquartered in New York or D.C. It only becomes a problem when you consider that they don't report on local issues, and many local news organizations that aren't centered in these places are dying. Find your local paper, if it still exists, and subscribe to it ASAP. Tell your friends and family to do so as well. Chapter 10. Self-care. A.K.A. How to Avoid Losing Your Mind While You're Changing the World. Caring for myself is not self-indulgence, it is self-preservation, and that is an act of political warfare, wrote poet, author, and activist Audre Lorde in her 1988 book, A Burst of Light. In the wake of the 2016 presidential election, a moment in which both self-preservation and political warfare felt paramount, self-care entered the public consciousness more intensely. Google searches for the term spiked during mid-November, as scared and anxious Americans attempted to soothe themselves. And, as is wont to happen with terms coined and used by activists and marginalized groups, once self-care became buzzy, it also became somewhat watered down. A simple Google search turns up lists with headlines such as 19 items to buy for your mental health because self-care isn't always free, and 9 products that won't let you forget about self-care this year, encouraging readers to purchase a $30 self-care journal or a $65 Jo Malone candle. Don't get me wrong, I love bougie candles as much as the next girl, and I don't fault anyone for enjoying these products. Products can be super fun, and retail therapy feels damn good. But I'm going to go out on a limb and assume that Audre Lorde was not thinking about going on a high-end bath product shopping spree when she wrote about self-preservation as political warfare. In 2012, Lucy McBath's 17-year-old son, Jordan Davis, was fatally shot by a man who objected to the loud music he and his friends were playing at a Jacksonville, Florida gas station. The tragedy rocked Lucy's world and plunged her into an identity crisis. She had been Jordan's mother for nearly 20 years. Who was she now? Lucy found herself leaning into her Christian faith for solace and talking to God. Now that I'm no longer his mother, what do you want me to do with my life? She asked. Her answer came in the form of a calling. She sensed that what had happened to Jordan would continue to happen to other young men of color, and that staying silent was no longer an option. She'd never considered herself an activist. Hell, she'd never even been a public speaker. But she had a voice, and she was going to use it. I felt like all I needed to do was open my mouth and see who would listen to me, she told me. I felt like God had given me a mandate, and I was going to have to speak out. I felt like even though Jordan is no longer here, physically, I'm still his mother, and I still need to parent him and protect him. A part of that was challenging the Stand Your Ground law. I'm going to challenge these laws, and I don't care what it takes. Whoever would be willing to listen to me, whoever would open their doors for me, I was going to speak to. And that is just what she did, and kept doing. She began speaking up about gun violence, police brutality, and racism. She told her story, and people listened. She launched a national campaign against Stand Your Ground laws, the law her son's killer used as a defense. He was convicted of first-degree murder in 2014, thanks to Lucy's work. She became the faith and outreach leader for Every Town for Gun Safety and a national spokesperson for Moms Demand Action for Gun Sense in America. She gave a moving address at the 2016 Democratic National Convention, standing shoulder to shoulder with other mothers of the movement. Other mothers who had lost their black children, Trayvon Martin, Eric Garner, Sandra Bland, Mike Brown, Hadiya Pendleton, Dontre Hamilton, at the hands of gun violence and police brutality. We're going to keep telling our children's stories and urging you to say their names, she told the DNC audience and the many more watching on television. We're going to keep building a future where police officers and communities of color work together in mutual respect to keep children, like Jordan, safe. And we're also going to keep using our voices and our votes to support leaders, like Hillary Clinton, who will help us protect one another so this club of heartbroken mothers stops growing. Lucy, if you can't already tell, is an extraordinary woman. She exudes warmth and compassion in a way I have rarely experienced. When we met up for lunch at a restaurant in Midtown Manhattan, she greeted me with a full-hearted hug, even though we had only met in person once before. If you sit and talk with Lucy, within 10 minutes you feel close to her, and sure she would fight for your humanity if you were ever in need of her voice. This unwavering dedication to other human beings also means that sometimes she can forget to take care of herself. Lucy describes the years immediately after Jordan's death as like being on a train that she couldn't get off. It wasn't until after the 2016 election that she realized she was completely burned out. I had planned to take a 3-month hiatus, which I did. I was gone after the election and didn't come back, formally, until March, she told me. It was the best thing I ever did because I really had a chance to figure out and create different ways to do this advocacy. When you're so mired in the work from day to day, I think you have the tendency to lose a lot of the creativity. Stepping back for a bit really gave me a chance to sit at home and rest and think about, what does this advocacy look like for me going forward? This story of burnout is a common one for activists. After all, the work of creating social change can be emotionally, mentally, and physically grueling. So what's one way to maintain a sense of sanity in the face of daily insanity? Self-care. For the women I spoke to for this book, who come from various spheres, backgrounds, and geographical locations, self-care is less about relaxation products and more about the intangibles, the space that allows you to take a step back, recharge your soul, and say yes to yourself so that you can continue saying yes to others in effective and creative ways. I asked extraordinary women how they practiced self-care. Here's what they said. Deja Fox, high school student and reproductive justice advocate. To me, self-care means respecting yourself and your efforts. I practice self-care in my busy schedule of activism, academics, and work by doing yoga and spending time with my friends and boyfriend. Lucy McBath, mother of the movement, spokesperson for Moms Demand Action, and faith outreach leader for Everytown. Weekends, holidays shut down. At 6 p.m., phones go off. You have to recognize that you're important. You're important to the movement. It's a matter of preserving your relationships. Relationships that you had to people before you became a part of the movement. You've got to nurture them. I did a lot of reading of things outside of gun violence prevention. Just reading stories and reading books and biographies that were not related to the struggle. Going to movies. Date night with my husband. It's important to understand and to recognize that you're just a human being and that this struggle is going to always be here, and it's going to be a long one, and we cannot solve it overnight. Wendy Davis, former state senator and founder of Deeds Not Words. Family and friends. And I have developed a skill over time that has really served me, which is to compartmentalize, to try to shut down and completely separate myself sometimes from the work, the policies that we care about, and to focus on something right in front of me, whether it's cooking a meal or going on a run or spending time with my baby granddaughter, just really focusing myself in that moment and enjoying and filling myself up by virtue of things that I enjoy. That really leaves your tank a lot fuller for the hard fights to come. Flavia Zodan, writer. If you look at my social media interactions, you will see that there are gaps. There are entire hours. I mean, not just when I'm sleeping. Disengaging is the key to self-care for me. I can work on other stuff, but without pressure of having to constantly be available. For me, self-care is not paying attention for a number of hours a day. Haley Stevens, congressional candidate. I have a mantra that's called pencils down. Knowing when to go pencils down, just like when you're at the end of a test. This is as much time as I have right now for this. Pencils down. The best thing is that when I put that pencil down, I can pick it right back up and I can get back to work. That's not going to go anywhere. I live in a beautiful part of southeastern Michigan where there are some trails, so running and walking, finding that time in the early morning to go for a run or get some exercise in is really helpful. Some of the best advice I got at the beginning of this was pencil it in and out. Pencil in, carve out the time now that you're going to be spending for you. Winnie Wong, founder of People for Bernie. I think the honest answer is that I don't practice self-care, but that does not mean I don't think about it. I practice self-care through constantly unpacking my courage. That, to me, is a form of self-care. It's about understanding and being grateful for my great health, my beautiful apartment, my hot boyfriend, and my pit bull. My hot boyfriend does my laundry for me. This is self-care for me. The fact that he is completely supportive in my work when I'm not available to ever make him macaroni and cheese anymore. This is all self-care to me. Just practicing gratitude for one's privilege is a form of practicing self-care. Carmen Perez, Women's March National Co-Chair. I wake up every morning and I intentionally am grateful for three things. I practice spirituality. I also work out and I try to eat healthy. So I really try to take care of my body, my mind, and my spirit. We're humans, right? So whenever we get death threats or we get people trolling us, of course you're going to have an emotional outburst. But I also know that I have a great, great, great support system. I have a very loving family. I try to model the types of relationships that I ask young people to have. And I also make sure that I keep those people who don't serve me at arm's length. Amanda Gorman, activist and youth poet laureate of the United States. I have an interesting self-care regimen, and it often revolves around Pixar movies. I really believe in the power of narratives, and so I hitch onto narratives that speak to me, and I'll reread in times of doubt. So whether that's rewatching Moana or rereading Harry Potter, I make sure that I take some time to embark on those narratives that help demonstrate what I care about. I meditate. I write. I play with my dog. And then, above all, I believe in what I call literary talismans. They're basically mantras that I repeat to myself in times of anxiety or insecurity, and they remind me of where I've come from, of the people whose shoulders I'm standing on, and what my values are. And so I kind of speak to myself a mantra about being the descendant of slaves, being the descendant of these black freedom fighters, and how I want to further continue this path of deliverance. And I repeat that to myself. And then I feel way more energized about the work that needs to get done. And I always try to get 6 hugs a day, at least. Hugs are perfect. Once you give a hug, you cannot stop. Janae Ingram, National Organizer and Head of Logistics for Women's March. For me, self-care is travel. I love to travel. When I feel like life is too much, or circumstances, issues, whatever it is too much for me, my outlet is through travel. I'm also really closely connected with my family. I see them very often. Those are the two things that, for me, I really do to practice self-care. It's about allowing myself to really unplug and not necessarily focus on what's happening on the news or what's happening out in the streets. Elizabeth Warren, United States Senator. Especially in this time of nonstop email, Facebook, and Twitter, and round-the-clock news, it can be tough to step back and take a deep breath. But I think it's really important to carve out time for yourself, to recharge and reset. This is going to be a marathon, not a sprint. I'm working on it, and I'm not there yet. I exercise, and I listen to audiobooks. I try not to check email late at night. Trump's 3 a.m. tweets will still be there tomorrow morning. I'm lucky to have a sweetie I'm crazy about, and grandkids and nieces and nephews who remind me why I'm in this fight. Shannon Watts, founder of Moms Demand Action for Gun Sense in America. I do a lot of meditation. I do a lot of yoga and working out. I'm married to an amazing, supportive husband. Honestly, my kids are older. That has helped me quite a bit, because to have little kids and to be doing this work would be harder. It doesn't mean it's insurmountable. My youngest was 12 when I started Moms Demand Action, and is almost 17 now. I think it's really important to recharge and go on vacation. I just climbed Mount Kilimanjaro, and I had zero choice to be completely inaccessible, and it was great. The world did not end. Gabrielle Gorman, filmmaker and Young Arts winner. I like to watch a lot of movies from my childhood. I feel like I've been doing that a lot more recently since the election. I'll watch stuff like The Grants and National Treasure and Scooby-Doo. Just sort of simple movies. I think that helps a lot. I try to tell people to find your thing. Find something really simple that you can watch. I love this one show, Psych, because there's not a lot of drama and it's comedic. I don't know if that's just because I'm a filmmaker that's the way I deal with it. I try to have a good balance. If I spend a lot of hours researching one thing that happened and I find myself really going into a hole, then I usually will come up with a battle plan for what I want to do to help that issue, whether it's a meeting, whether it's writing about it or putting it on my list of films to make. Then I will take a break and watch an episode of just some ditzy show. Kayla Briett, filmmaker, composer, and musician. I think the hardest thing about self-care is harnessing the power to say no, to know when it's more important to kind of back down or pass an opportunity to someone else or ask for help. Saying no doesn't make you a weak person. It's really important to take that time to gather energy just by being by yourself and to take time to have fun and to take time to reward yourself for hard work. Sarah McBride, National Press Secretary for the Human Rights Campaign and LGBTQ activist. I think that's something that all of us struggle with. There was a point in my life where I realized, when I was caring for Andy, Sarah's husband who passed away from cancer in 2014, that the only way I could care for him is if I took care of myself, and if I dealt with emotions that I was feeling. I think there was this instinct, particularly as someone who was always so hyper-aware of my own privilege, that when Andy was dying of cancer, to be like, stop feeling sorry for yourself. You're not dying. And while that's true, and while that's a helpful perspective, and while my plight in no way was comparable to Andy's, I still needed to be able to grapple with my own feelings of negativity and fear and sadness. I still had to sleep and have moments of joy and levity. That experience underscored for me the cliche when it comes to self-care, that you can't help other people if you're not helping and taking care of yourself. For me, honestly, that includes watching a lot of reality television. That is sort of an escape that allows me to, I don't want to say turn my mind off, because a lot of those shows actually are, there's a lot to unpack in them, but allows me to sort of escape in some ways. I have very strong feelings about this because it's another instance of this punishment of women who engage in levels of self-care through popular culture. Men, when they engage in self-care through consuming popular culture that disproportionately appeals to men, society doesn't blink an eye. But when women engage in, or when any person engages in self-care that deals with popular culture that disproportionately appeals to women, whether it's music or whether it's television, what have you, it's dismissed as superficial, as vapid, as even dangerous to culture. I think people need to set that bullshit aside and allow people to enjoy the shit that they enjoy. Ai-Jen Poo, director of the National Domestic Workers Alliance and co-director of Caring Across Generations. I believe in having a practice, something that helps you connect to the essence of who you are and why you do what you do. For me, that's yoga and my yoga practice every morning. For some people, it's running. Some people, it's art. Other people, it's music. Whatever it is that helps remind you of who you are and what you stand for. I believe in vacation. Workers fought for weekends and vacation time for a reason. And I believe in taking those and doing it with people that you love, because I think that's a big part of how we nourish ourselves for the long haul. Jackie Cruz, actress and activist. I am one of those people who doesn't stop working. But you gotta take care of yourself, or else you can't make a difference. You have to be kind to yourself. I definitely try to eat healthy, and I treat my body with respect. And I love to express gratitude. When you don't get an audition or when your world is falling apart, when Trump is your new president, I definitely write down everything that I'm grateful for. Marlo Thomas, award-winning actress, author, and activist. As an activist, I find it important to practice self-care so that you don't burn out. You always want to be rested and ready to step up to the next challenge. And you can't do that without an ample reservoir of energy, passion, good health, goodwill, and good humor. Everyone practices self-care in their own ways. Some meditate, some jog, some get a massage, some take a purposeless walk just to enjoy the smell of the flowers and the company of passers-by. I personally like to exercise, run in the park, lift weights. It gets me out of my busy brain and works off stress as well as pounds. I also love to go to comedy clubs, because laughter always seems to re-energize me. But the bottom line is, it's about taking the kind of care of yourself as you do everyone else in your life. Women are natural caretakers, but the one person we seem not to have time to care for is ourselves. This idea of self-care gives a name to that carelessness. It's important that we feel good, both physically and emotionally, which includes making sure we eat well, get a decent amount of sleep, and don't forget to cuddle up with someone we love. That feels good, too. Tina Chen, former Chief of Staff to First Lady Michelle Obama and Executive Director of the Obama White House Council on Women and Girls. We live in a time where we are constantly entrenched in messages and media. Read this, watch this, share this. Sometimes it's good to turn everything off and to reflect. I think especially in the space of public service, where you're dealing with a multitude of issues and where you're concerned with the well-being of far more than just yourself, it's important to take time to personally react and respond to how certain issues make you feel. In recent months, self-care to me has been traveling, catching up with friends and family who I haven't seen as much over the years, and spending time with my children. Oh, and binge-watching all the shows I haven't had a chance to watch. Bob Bland, Women's March National Co-Chair. Honestly, we never really stopped to take a break after the march, because right after was the Muslim ban, and that was just the beginning. The way that I've practiced self-care is that we're very intentional about spending time with our families and not allowing the most important connections in our lives to suffer. Because what's the point of doing this work if your family comes out of it feeling like they lost you? I try to celebrate even small victories where we can connect with each other as a community. The Women's March organizers may not have known each other when we started, but now we're this very close-knit family of organizers who have been through a once-in-a-lifetime experience together. Organizing the Women's March was like gaining an entire new family. Raquel Willis, organizer and writer. For me, self-care isn't something that is so organized or well thought out. I think that when we start to be too structured around self-care, that can actually become work and become less restorative than we would hope. So currently, self-care to me is building personal relationships that don't hinge on what's going on in the movement. There's the need for spaces where you can just breathe and people you can just worry about mundane things with and not have to worry about saving the world, because none of us are superheroes. None of us can run on being invincible. So we need to have those outlets of just normality to branch out into. Also, for me, self-care is relaxing. Self-care is watching ridiculous shows on Netflix or Hulu, or it's lighting candles. It's massages. It's lying out in the sun, being out in fresh air. It's reading and writing that doesn't necessarily have anything to do with this capitalist system that we're a part of. Wazina Zandan, co-creator of Coming Out Muslim, Radical Acts of Love. Some days it's saying no, and actually accepting affirmation and acknowledgement and being proud. Maybe once a year, for me I do it during Ramadan and I do it during birthday times, is looking at the last year and making a list of things I'm so proud of and also thanking the people in my life who helped me get there. Self-care is also watching The Office on repeat. I don't watch hard TV. I don't even engage haters anymore. Self-care is no longer reading comments. Jamia Wilson, Executive Director and Publisher of the Feminist Press at City University of New York. For me, it's really about not suffering in silence, connecting with other people in solidarity. Another thing is, as I've gotten older and managing autoimmune illnesses that I have, I feel like my body has created a status for itself that lets me know when I'm working too hard and pushes me to stop. So I really take the time to sleep. I also delegate and share opportunities with other people. When I get opportunities to recommend other people to participate in something who might not have that access, to me that is very much a sense of self-care, because it makes me feel good to help support other people, but also it helps me feel like I don't have to carry so much. The last thing I would say is I am now near nature, or as near to nature as you can get in New York City, and I take a walk in the park every day. And I just look at ducks, and sometimes I just sit by the water, and it's really great. I have this practice that I learned from an indigenous grandmother who I met at a spiritual workshop, and she taught me a ritual of releasing pain into trees by hugging them and kind of asking the trees permission to unleash what you're carrying into them. So I actually hug trees. It's always funny to tell the conservatives in my life about that. I actually am a tree hugger. Ashley Judd, actor, author, and activist. I practice self-care by prioritizing it. I can't transmit that which I do not have. And I love the saying that self-care isn't selfish, it is self-esteem. The patriarchy wants to diminish me in every way, and that includes through sheer exhaustion. Getting enough sleep, which for me is 10.5 hours per night, is really important. Exercise is very important for my brain, as well as for my sense of being physically capable. I am veganish, which is for my health, as well as a deeply moral and ethical choice for me. I think reading Audre Lorde about self-care is important to understand why the body is a site of political and social resistance and transformation. I use my voice, write, and find the courage to live my truth in often unfriendly public spaces, which can be made safe by strong female-to-female alliances, which, when it comes to self-care, are perhaps the coup de grace. Having fun and laughing regularly are a part of self-care. As much as I need community, I also need long stretches of solitude and silence. Being in nature is critical for me. It is both emergency room and church for my spirit. I love to hike and backpack, and especially enjoy solo backcountry backpacking in the Appalachian Mountains. Alicia Garza, co-founder of Black Lives Matter Network and Special Projects Director at the National Domestic Workers Alliance. For me, self-care is about cultivating my ability to be resilient in the face of oppression and domination. That means I try to be very intentional about cultivating communities that care for me and can hold me accountable to what it takes for me to move toward my vision. Manicures are nice, but that isn't self-care for me. For me, self-care is the spaces that I help to create where I get to access my resilience. That could mean making time for a dance-off with friends, having a support circle, or spending time alone. But I hesitate to only call things that cost money self-care, when so much of what so many of us struggle with is having access to the resources we need to make ends meet. For an inspirational playlist, a guide to film and television, and a list of organizations to check out, please refer to the supplemental enhancement PDF available at time of purchase from your audiobook provider. This is Andy Arndt. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of A Girl's Guide to Joining the Resistance, a feminist handbook on fighting for good, by Emma Gray. This program was produced by B Audio Limited. Executive producer, Caitlin Gehring. Text copyright 2018 by Emma Gray. Production copyright 2018 by HarperCollins Publishers. All rights reserved. Thank you for listening.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.